Well, let's get started in a kind of a slow way, and then we'll get warmed up. My name's Hal Tausig. I teach at Union Theological Seminary in New York in New Testament, and I'm a United Methodist pastor. As I was talking with Cindy and Stephanie about I've always wanted to come to Holden for like the last 20 years. Susan, my partner here, and I had a speaking gig in the Seattle area, and we seized the day, and then Cindy and Stephanie and I sort of pasted something together. And I'm going to talk about a book that was one of my 13 books, but is just published this March, and this is my first trade book. Trade book is, you know, the big publishers. So this, and it's called A New Testament, a 21st Century Bible, combining traditional and newly discovered texts. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but I want to talk a little bit about that in relationship to what you all experience and what's important to you. So I'm going to just ask a couple of introductory questions for me to get a feel for where you are. So one of the things that has been gripping for me in my last 15 to 20 years of both ministry and professorate has been the discovery of and the coming to light, to public light, of a whole bunch of new books from the earliest of Christianities. And combining reading them with the traditional New Testament. And so that's what this book is about, and I have a copy of it here. Leave it in your library after I leave. But tell me, when I say there were a bunch of things discovered from the first and second century of the Christ movements of that day, do you know their names? What do you know about this stuff? Yes.
The Book of Judas.
The Gospel of Judas.
Or that one. Yeah.
Gospel of Judas.
The Gnostic Gospels.
The Gnostic Gospels. And so that's kind of a phrase that Elaine Pagels, a good colleague of mine, has phrased that she applies to about maybe 20 books.
Mm-hmm. Non-canonical books.
Yeah, non-canonical books from the first two centuries. And under that, she discusses things like the Gospel of Mary, the Thunder Perfect Mind, the Gospel of Thomas, and the like. Yeah. So the Gnostic Gospels, I want to actually dismantle, if we have a little time, that label that she's put on it.
Okay.
Because I think it actually alienates it from the New Testament in ways that need not to have happened. Anybody else know the name of a book that has been discovered in the last two centuries that comes from the first or second century? That some of it gets, you know, pretty a bunch of press and some of it doesn't. Well, anybody? Yes.
I'll just say it's not really the writings of Josephus have a lot to do with what we know about first century books.
So he's a Jewish historian. What I'm talking about are people who more or less love Jesus and write books about him in the first two centuries, and are by and large books and are not books that are in the traditional New Testament. Anybody heard of the Gospel of Mary? Mm-hmm. Okay, yes and no. Across there, Gospel of Mary Magdalene, discovered in the last part of the 19th century. The only gospel we have in writing whose protagonist is a woman, Mary, probably Magdalene. We'll probably be able to say a little bit more about that later. Anybody know about the Gospel of Thomas? Mm-hmm. Some mostly yeses there. 114 little mini chapters, all sayings or teachings of Jesus, about half of which we have similar sayings from in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and about half of those mini chapters we've never heard of. So Gospel of Thomas, a whole bunch of sayings of Jesus, half of which we more or less have in the canonical book, and half of which we have none of. One of the most important books for Elaine Pagels in her 1979 book on all of the, a bunch of this material was The Thunder Perfect Mind. Anybody hear of The Thunder Perfect Mind? Yes, right. Thunder Perfect Mind is a the voice of God. Proclaiming I am this and I am that, very much like Jesus in the Gospel of John, but with amazing twists. Let me, I'll just read you to get you started. I'll read you The Thunder Perfect Mind, just a little bit of the first chapter. I was sent from power. I came to those pondering me, and I was found among those seeking me. Look at me, all of you who contemplate me. Audience, hear me. I am the first and the last. I am she who was honored and she who is mocked. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am he, the mother and the daughter. I am the limbs of my mother. Pay attention to me, to my impoverishment and to my extravagance. Do not be arrogant to me when I am thrown to the ground. You will find me among the expected. Do not stare at me in the shit pile, leaving me discarded. You will find me in the kingdoms. Do not stare at me when I am thrown out among the condemned. Do not laugh at me in the lowest places. Do not throw me down among those slaughtered viciously. I myself am compassionate, and I am cruel. Do not hate my compliance and do not love my restraint. Anyway, some of you, most of you probably never heard that. Actually, it's been celebrated in major artistic documents of the last 20 years. Umberto Eco has a whole chapter in Foucault's Pendulum on it. The first African-American film director to produce a Hollywood film, Julia Dash, has that as the opening statement in her award-winning film, The Daughters of the Dust. Toni Morrison has used a quote from The Thunder Perfect Mind, some of which I actually read there, for her for the introductory dedication in her novels Parade and Jazz. So anyway, it's around. Some people know about it, some people don't. Okay, so that gives me a little feel for what, where you are on some of the things that have gripped people when they've been discovered and they found them, and some of them that you may not know about. I want to tell you just a little bit about how I got into this. So, as a professor of New Testament, it seemed to me that I needed to know about this material. By and large, when I was in seminary and doing doctoral studies, I wasn't taught it. It was actually sort of outside of the frame of theological education. But in the last 30 years, people have been knowing more about these new early Christian documents. And for the last 15 years, I would say, both in my speaking engagements around the country, in my local ministry in Philadelphia, and in my teaching at Union Theological Seminary, I've had the more or less the same experience over and over again. And that is, I will say to them, hey, you want to hear the Gospel of Mary? Let's read the Gospel of Mary along with the Gospel of Luke. And by the end of the evening, I'll have one of several responses. The first one is almost always the same, and that is, why don't we know about this? The second is, why isn't this in my Bible? The third, and for me most memorable, and it comes over and over again, is something like, I feel like I've found my long-lost brother or sister when I hear these voices. I love that especially because it indicates that when you read, say, like the Gospel of Mary alongside of the Gospel of Luke, it's actually as if they're sister and brother in voice, that they expand one another in what we know was the spirit moving in early Christianity. So I don't know. So for at least the last 15 years, I've been talking to lay groups across the country, speaking at professorial conventions and the like. And it takes someone only with a modicum of intelligence, that would be me. If somebody says this thing to you hundreds of times, you eventually say, well, maybe we should put some of these good, newly discovered, ancient Christian documents in the same binding as the traditional New Testament. In other words, in some ways, so I was the chief editor of this, and I've written all of the introductions to this, but it wasn't my idea at all. I just was plodding along in my professorial and ministerial tasks, and finally sunk in. And so over the past several years, an agent introduced me to some of the main CEOs of publishing companies around the country, and they had an auction to see who got to publish this book. And that was fun. But one of the things that occurred to me along the way is, so if we're going, and so the deal was with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, who published it, the deal was, okay, we're going to print all of the 27 books of the traditional New Testament, and we're going to add some from the earliest of Christianities that seem to be valuable to people. So I thought, well, this has way too much hubris anyway as an idea, way too much nerve. And I thought, so I can't choose the books to be added. So Houghton Mifflin Harcourt agreed to have me gather about 20 spiritual leaders nationally across the country and have them vote, basically study for a year all these documents, and then vote on which should be added. And so I said, this is not a scholarly decision, although scholarship matters. I said, what matters are real spiritual leaders in our country who've spent most of their lifetime deciding what is important to read for spirit and faith. And so I got bishops. I called up bishops. And I thought, they don't know me from anybody. And I asked them, would you be on this? And I said, by the way, the publisher won't pay you any money because that would be a conflict of interest. But the bishop said, yes. The head of the United Church of Christ, I called him up out of the blue. And he said, well, sure. Barbara Brown Taylor, John Dominic Crossan, Karen King, all said yes. We got amazing diversity of life perspective. Almost half of the what we now call the Council for the New Testament. Almost half of them are people of color, but major leaders in our country. So they got together during 2012, and it was funny. You know, you look at a bishop and you say, "Have you ever heard of Thunder Perfect Mind?" And they say, "No." And I said, well, it's your job, without payment, while you're being a bishop, to actually read it and think about it. And by the way, we have 75 books like that you need to read. And so during the year, they filtered it down and finally voted on the last 10. And so they decided to add 10 books to a New Testament. By the way, I've been insisting it's not the New Testament. We might have a chance to talk a little bit later about how long it took to put together the traditional New Testament. Anybody want to guess on that? How long did it take to, for the New Testament that we know to become together, to come together?
367 was the first time in Egypt they gathered this 27 books that we know.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So 367 CE or AD was the first time anybody had the idea that the 27 books that we read now should be, should have any privilege. And the bishop, the North African bishop who chose those 27, it was in his Easter letter. So, by the way, here, happy Easter, here are 27 books that I think should be privileged. So it wasn't a council. The first
do we know if any of these books that were newly discovered were part of the what was considered?
Well, we know some of it, and we don't know some of it. Yeah, that's such a great question. The weird thing about the the first 300 and some years, and then the subsequent 200 years after that idea, people started processing, well, do we like these 27 or not? And it turned out not everybody did. Not every bishop liked that. There was no council. No church-wide council that ever voted on what's in the New Testament until the Council of Trent in the 16th century. Now, in the meantime, Jerome translates all this, a bunch of stuff into Latin, and he uses those 27 books in the 5th century. So anyway, I'm getting off topic. But so I said, you can't have the New Testament. You need 500 years or something like that. But it does seem like there's a deep spiritual thirst and some sense of disappointment or boredom in the traditional New Testament, enough that maybe provisionally adding 10 books might help. And so that's what this Council for a New Testament did, is they chose from 75 books, 10 more to add. And they admitted that they just studied them, and I said, you don't have, again, I don't want you to make a scholarly judgment. I want you to say what's spiritually helpful for people. What helps them pray? What helps them make trusting and faithful decisions? Since you have a lot of readership.
For all of these 75 books, did you have them in their entireties? Or, because what I understand from, isn't it the Gospel of Mary, don't we have fragments of the Gospel of Mary, but not the whole thing, right? Is that?
That's right. So we gave them as much as we could.
Sure, yeah, because some has been lost to time. Yeah.
Some of you may know that, for instance, the earliest 10 copies of the Gospel of Mark we have are not nearly complete, have big lacuna and big holes in them. And the Gospel of Mark, of course, we're still arguing. You may know that the Gospel of Mark, if you look at your Bible, how the Gospel of Mark ends in chapter 16, there are three endings. And we tend to not know which is. So, and the Gospel of Mary,
we just have our dialogue, right? That's where we have the Gospel.
Yeah, so the Gospel of Mary, we're missing maybe, we think, 6 columns, and it begins with Jesus teaching, and then all of a sudden Jesus says goodbye forever, and the disciples start crying. And Mary steps up and says, hey, don't cry. He told me a bunch of things he didn't tell you. Well, they say, well, that's good. Tell us. And so she says, okay, here's what he said. And then about half of that is lost of what he said. And then the story picks up at the end of what she said he said. and Andrew and Peter say, I don't think so. They say, first of all, this is much different than what we thought and what we've heard. So, and secondly, why would he have told a woman?
Mm-hmm.
And then Levi steps in and says, Peter, you're always a hothead. You know, good thing you, by the way, know that he loved her more than us. And then, depending on which version, because we have two manuscripts, all of the disciples go out and proclaim this good news, or only Levi goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And hauntingly enough, it doesn't say what Mary did.
Huh.
So anyway, Gospel of Mary, is an example of a fragmented text, but as the Council for a New Testament voted, all these denominational leaders and Barbara Brown Taylor and John Dominic Cross and the like, the Gospel of Mary got the most votes. The Thunder Perfect Mind got the next most votes. The Gospel of Thomas got the next, and so on. And then the publisher, Houghton Mifflin and Harcourt, was so generous, they said, add as many as you want. Just, and then the council was very cautious. They said, we only want the real winners. And we're going to, so Houghton Mifflin and Harcourt said, we'll go until, you can go that way. And then the council said, when there's a break in how many votes, we'll make that break. So I can talk to you about some of the books we put in. We can talk about how the clumsy and obtuse process of deciding on the original canon happened. Let me just stop for a moment. You all have been jumping in nicely, but let's stop and see. So I kind of probed at the beginning of our time together as to how much you knew, and frankly, I would say you know more than some and less than a bunch of others in the public about that. And so maybe what I just did in the last 12 minutes needs some clarification.
Yeah, one question. What translation did you use to publish?
It was fun, messy, and a lot of work. So one of my PhD students from Union, I asked her to be the director of translation, and so she translated 8 of the New Coptic. She made 8 of the New Coptic translations and 1 of the Greek translations. One of the books was already translated, and we got it accepted from the new translator. And then the bigger question, which is more boring in some ways, is how did we, what did we use for the translation of the traditional New Testament? Because and I'll say in a minute something about this. There are a bunch of translations out there. So how do you decide? So we said, well, the standard one for many people is the NRSV, the New Revised Standard Version.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about that is, you know, whatever the rights are, or however much you would have to pay for that, guess who gets it? The National Council of Churches. So anytime you use that and pay for it, the National Council of Churches gets the money. But what the problem was, this is a trade book. So the price for me would have been $600,000 to use the NRSV. So we went to another one, and which allowed us to use the translations of the new books to have comparable translations and change some of theirs. It's called the Open English Bible.
This project in general, how much resistance or acceptance has there been? Maybe you've already asked.
No, thanks. I don't know. We're only just 5 months into it. You know, bunches of media coverage. My purpose is to sort of continue the longer term conversation I've had with the public on this for a long time. Two of my colleagues at Union told me to get a bodyguard. They meant it wasn't a joke. But it turns out nothing like that. Apparently the blogosphere, which I never had time quite to you know, read a lot of. It has a bunch of hostile stuff in it. I've spoken on, you know, a whole bunch of radio programs and newspaper interviews and the like. I have yet to have someone blow up about it.
Hmm.
So we're right now working on a big session at the American Academy of Religion, Society of Biblical Literature, in which we'll get a couple of evangelical leaders to be in conversation with me about it. Because it seems like right now it's mostly folks being very interested, curious, and excited about it. So I kind of wish that there would be more debate about it. I don't think I want to go for controversy, but it seems like this thing needs debate in order to refine. So in the book itself, I say, please, someone else put together another New Testament. This is going to take generations. So we need critique and all of that. But I'm hoping for some of that. But right now, in my local church, they trained each other for their demonstrators, and none came.
So do you have a date range that these writings?
Yeah. We worked pretty hard on that in the group that decided it. We had a kind of a subcommittee of the scholars on the council. So that was Karen King, Stephen Moore, John Dominic Crossan, Margaret Amer, and myself. And we put 175 as the latest a new book could be written, because we thought that it was the people who make a case that Second Peter could be that late. Had a good case. We don't know.
Right.
So Karen King pushed really hard in the sessions to expand it to 203, because her favorite book that she wanted added was The Diary of Perpetua. And so she won that vote, so they overruled me. And The Diary of Perpetua was a candidate but didn't get finally chosen.
So it's 175, and then do you know what the earliest writing?
Well, that's weird. Yes, the weird thing is that The Thunder Perfect Mind, which I just read from you, and which got the second most votes by the council, it could have been written before Jesus.
Okay.
Scholarship thinks that The Thunder Perfect Mind could have been written anywhere between 100 BCE to 300 CE. So, and again, I guess I want to say, I tell my students and my parishioners, never trust what a scholar says. I mean, we're making half of it up all the time. So I don't really want to claim we really know when a lot of this is written. It's guesstimate. It's really important to do, and it's important to admit that we're wrong a bunch.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? I'm going to jump in on a couple of other levels in a minute. Yes.
I know little or nothing about this, so my questions may be very, very basic. When were these books discovered? Have they been known about?
That's really an important thing to ask, and I'll give you the really short, clumsy answer. So there have been many discoveries in the last 140 years in different places. Some of them have been in libraries, ancient libraries. Some of them have been in monastic libraries. Some of them have been in the basement of current museums, because there are a lot of stuff that has been processed. So for instance, Cambridge and Oxford University sponsored an archaeological dig in the 1880s in the ancient city of Oxyrhynchus, they found an ancient trash dump. And they spent 10 years carting up all of the trash, the papyri in this trash dump from the first century, first and second century, and they sent it all back to England. Since 1890, they've been working on that, a team. They've gone through about 8% of what they found.
Oh my gosh.
And they found already two partial gospels that we never knew existed.
Just the discovery of this is fascinating.
Exactly. But then the other kind of Cliff Notes answer is, the ones we voted on, 7 of those 10 that we voted in out of the, say, 75 that we said we were choosing from, were all found in the same place, and that's Nag Hammadi. So the Nag Hammadi discovery happened in 1945 in Egypt as well. And again, Egypt, we were finding most stuff in Egypt because of the climate in North Africa. It's dry, mm-hmm. and it preserves papyrus. Mm-hmm. It's not because, although it's important for us to take seriously how important Egypt was in early Christianity. It's not because it like had a corner on the writing market. It's just that papyri in Greece tends to disappear from the forces of nature where it doesn't in Egypt. But Nag Hammadi, little village in central Egypt, some peasants in 1945 found. So, you know, when the Nile floods and then it goes back into its banks, one of the things that Egyptian farmers do is after it goes back into its banks, they go into the hills and they look for fertilizer because there's there are deposits that they can gather for their crops. These guys were up in the hills looking and they found a jar. 52 documents inside that jar.
Huh.
And 7 of those we put in an New Testament. Gospel of Thomas is the most celebrated part of Nag Hammadi, although the Thunder Perfect Mind. They're basically all some kind of Christian, early Christian writing, although there is a partial copy of Plato's Republic. But we know that, of course, the early Christian writers quoted and used Plato in their writing anyway, so they might have considered Plato sacred too. And again, that's way before the New Testament was picked up. So that's kind of a sense of it. There, you know, for instance, if I had more time, I'd tell you how the Gospel of Mary was found, which is a lovely story. It took 70 years after it was found for it to get translated because of people dying and plumbing emergencies and everything like that.
Well, the religious doesn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
I'm sure one of the challenges, too, is that with the traditional Gospels, we know that they were, because they were canonized, they were distributed in a huge way and became this cornerstone of early Christians around the empire and around the world. And I suppose it's really hard to know how were some of these distributed. Were they localized? Were they very important documents in their local communities? Or were they distributed in a broader context?
Well, that's such a great question. The first thing I want to say is we're trying to be careful about how much the canonical books were distributed, because most of the manuscripts that we have are at least 300 to 600 years, maybe sometimes 800 years later than the writing. Mm-hmm. So in other words, just because we have a whole bunch of manuscripts of the Gospel of John doesn't mean that we know how widely it was distributed.
Sure.
On the other hand, the Gospel of Thomas, which wasn't a part of that, and one might say maybe it wasn't distributed, we already have linguistic knowledge that it was distributed in at least two languages. So we have the Nag Hammadi Gospel of Thomas was in Coptic.
Yeah.
One of the amazing things that happened, though, is once we translated the Coptic, we discovered that we already had portions of the Gospel of Thomas in Greek that we didn't know were the Gospel of Thomas.
Ah, interesting.
So the major wonderful parallels to the Gospel of Thomas, because from all kinds of different places now, fragments of Thomas are appearing. So, in other words, I would caution us to say the canonical ones were more distributed than the non-canonical. It's difficult to say that the things were widely distributed were the things that also got criticized.
Mm.
So, for instance, also the Gospel of John seems to be implicitly critiquing the Gospel of Thomas.
Mm.
Irenaeus in the second century, the one gospel that we put in that was critiqued in the first three centuries was the Gospel of Truth.
Mm.
And he says, don't read it. Irenaeus does. Irenaeus, of course, is the first person we think to use the term the New Testament. He doesn't mean what we mean. He just means as opposed to the Old Testament. It's not a collection, the New Testament. But Irenaeus also says, listen, there are four Gospels that you have to read.
Interesting.
And he names Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know why he names four Gospels? He gives us the reason. Because there are four winds that blow at four corners of the earth.
Huh.
Great reasoning, right?
Wow.
You want to take that to your theological bank. So, in other words, it's a really delicate moment. And what we're finding is, of course, a lot of people, as I said, are wanting to, are finding spiritual comfort. I mean, what is it like to read the Gospel of Mary? You talk to almost any group in this country, and they'll say, I want more of this, I want to know more about it, and this changes a whole bunch. I want to say one thing before we get to your question. So, one of the things that has happened in the discovery of these new documents are two things. First of all, we in the Guild didn't do a good job of thinking about the discoveries as they came at us. We were frightened. We were frightened because we didn't know it very well. We were frightened because we were intensely tied to the way things were. And so the Guild's immediate response to almost all discoveries is, it must be heresy.
Hmm.
Can you explain what the Guild is?
The scholars, the scholarly Guild,
okay.
Those of us who are licensed. We've been really slow and counterintuitive, I think, on that front. So, and by the way, you won't hear, scholars don't like to say that's heresy. That's not a part of scholarly parlance anymore. But there's a code word for it, and you already gave it to us.
Gnostics. Gnostics, right.
So it turns out that the 20th century produced the term Gnostic so that was a way of saying, be careful with this stuff. It turns out, as Karen King has shown in her recent books, professor at Harvard of New Testament and Early Christianity, that the term Gnostic was never defined. It was more simply a slander. I mean, if you read all the books about what is Gnosticism, they disagree on what Gnosticism is. King just charts that clearly. But the second thing that happened to these new discoveries, and this has to do, of course, with the decline of Christianity, I think, in our time, is that the new discoveries got romanticized. In other words, I think it doesn't take any... The reason that Elaine, and again, I owe much to Elaine, she's a good colleague, but the reason that Elaine Pagels, very popular book, the Gnostic Gospels, sold is because it said the new stuff is better. She has a number of sections in both her old and new books in which she says, listen, look how, for instance, in her book on the Gospel of Thomas, she says, look how much better the Gospel of Thomas is than the Gospel of John. So I guess I want to say, for my kind of plodding journey with this stuff, trying to be responsive to my local parishioners who say, tell me more about the Acts of Paul and Thecla. I've said there are two real big mistakes that we've made already. One is to think that the new documents are all heresy. The other is to think that it's the best stuff. So what this book, this project, recommends, and what I've been doing for the last 15 years is saying, let's pair them off. And let's, so Cindy and Stephanie, in my conversation with them last week when we were deciding what this session would be, I said, well, let's do an in-depth comparison of the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Luke. She said, no, we're not ready for that. but that's what I like to do in my classes, in my local church, and in my speaking around the country. I like to say, so let's kind of just read these together and see how much they teach each other or expand on each other. And so that's a pretty careful, not as dramatic a reading of what can, these documents can and can't do, both for understanding what early Christianity was and for coming into serious relationship with the movement of the Spirit through the reading of the those texts with and without the traditional New Testament. Okay, I'm going to cheat for 5 more minutes because we said we were going to stop at 6:45. Back of you.
I guess my basic question is, so with the new writings, are there, I mean, I haven't read most of them, I've read a few sections of Thomas, but are there changes in theology? I mean, or are they contradictions to the old New Testament?
I use the traditional New Testament. But, yeah. Yes. But, of course, the thing that has also happened is that for a long time, we've noticed that the New Testament disagrees with itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, so let's just take the issue of women speaking. There are clear examples within the traditional New Testament that women speak powerfully in the assembly, and clear prohibitions of that. So in other words, that early Christianity was diverse. We actually are beginning to live into in just the study of the traditional New Testament. But yes, there are striking critiques of one another if you expand it too. And that's why it seems to me that, for me, the final test is not some kind of scholarly proof or theory, but the faithful living with books to see if they're nurturing and challenging. I think you put Paul and Matthew in the same room in the first century, and you got one big argument.
Yeah.
We already know Paul and Peter, didn't we?
Right, exactly, yeah.
But I guess my one comment about the part that you read at the beginning,
The Thunderbird Mind.
Yeah. That doesn't, to me, having never heard that, but having read the New Testament, the tone of that is very different than anything Jesus said in a lot of ways. I mean, it doesn't sound like Jesus speaking, and maybe it's not supposed to be Jesus.
Well, no, yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think that's the response of a number of folks. On the other hand, Jesus and John says, I am the bread of life, I am the way, the truth, and the life, I am the good shepherd, I am the bread of life.
But he doesn't say, I am good and I am evil, I am the virgin and the whore, I'm not, he doesn't, And I was trying to, when you were reading that, I was trying to think, so where, I haven't heard that in any of the traditional texts that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was frankly very surprised when the group of national Christian leaders said, we think this is gospel.
So I haven't heard that
rationale, by the way, that's no problem. That rationale for thunder is based mainly on a comparison with John, because and again, the voice is mainly feminine in thunder, but the comparison there is that, in contrast to most of the divine self-proclamations in the ancient world, thunder's voice is humiliated and cast down, as I said, herself. She's cast down among those slaughtered. John, of course, has this basically revealing God who's proclaiming himself as God or divine, and he gets crucified.
And what?
And he gets crucified. Yeah. So the comparison there is that. And it's really interesting just to experience in my local church, there are people just whose lives have been changed by thunder, maybe for the better, someone might say, or for the worse. But I would say we'll know that in a couple of generations. Yeah, one more question.
Just a quick question. Is this coming out in paperback?
I think next year, but the thing is, it's $18 in hardback.
Oh, wow.
That's great.
And it's on, you can get it on Kindle and everything. I don't know what the paperback's going to cost if the hardback is 18 bucks. You can get it on Amazon in a flash for practically nothing. And I'm not here to sell you books. I covenanted with you for no more than 10 of, so let's stop. I'm happy to hang here, but I want to go to Vespers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to, Susan, my partner, and I will be here until 2 o'clock, or 1:30 tomorrow afternoon. I'll be hanging at around here after Vespers and so on, and at breakfast tomorrow if you want to grab me.
Great.
Susan and I have been wanting to come here for a long time. We're glad we got our speaking engagement out here and we're able to arrange this. It's a great honor to be among you.
Thank you.